Following are some comments on William Shakespeare's Pericles, Prince of Tyre, Act 4. Both the heart and place of general wonder, Marina has grown to be a lovely teenage girl, which fills Dionysa with murderous envy for the sake of her own slighted daughter. In Chorus 4, John Gower again sets the scene for us, this time at Ephesus, where Dionysa is about to betray Pericles by plotting to kill his daughter Marina. The deed takes shape out of Dionysa's quote-unquote rare, meaning intense, envy for the gifts that allow the girl to outshine her daughter Philoten. Marina, says Gower, is widely held to be, quote-unquote, both the heart and place of general wonder. Act 4, Chorus, lines 10 through 11. The ghostly medieval poet also says memorably of his own presence and capabilities, quote-unquote, only I carry winged time, post on the lame feet of my rhyme, which never could I so convey, unless your thoughts went on my way. Act 4, Chorus, lines 47 through 50. He humbly submits that he is simply a device to spur the audience to appreciation for its own imaginative gifts. 'Tis but a blow which never shall be known. Dionysa commissions base-born Leonine to murder Marina while the two walk along the shoreline, but pirates abduct her before Leonine can strike. In Act 4, Scene 1, as Gower has already told us in his choral remarks, Dionysa is envious because Marina has been winning all the praise that would otherwise go to her daughter, Philoten. Using the excuse that Marina is discomposed due to her grief over the death of Lycorida, Dionysa sets her servant Leonine the task of cutting the young woman down while they're walking along the shore. Marina pleads with Leonine to no avail, but just then, pirates turn up and relieve Leonine of the need to kill Marina. Ironically, by abducting her, they save her life. As for Leonine, he is as villainous as one can imagine, in spite of his relatively soft manner. He lurks in the background on the off chance that the pirates, quote-unquote, will but please themselves, violating Marina and taking her aboard rather than killing her. Act 4, Scene 1, line 98. But if they violate her and leave her on shore alive, he says, he will then still need to carry out his murderous commission. Dionysa's pep talk to this base-born servant is remarkable for its callousness. She tells him that as for this act of murder she has solicited him to commit, quote-unquote, 'tis but a blow which never shall be known. Act 4, Scene 1, Line 2. I have cried her almost to the number of her hairs. Pander, Bolt, and Baud in Mytilene on Lesbos don't know quite how to induct virtuous Marina into the trade of prostitution that is their business. The Norton editors point out that Act 4, Scene 2 has a distinctly English feel, and in Shakespeare and the Invention of the Human, critic Harold Bloom is probably right to suggest in his essay on Pericles that Pander, Baud, and Bolt are the liveliest and most carefully individuated characters in the play. Indeed, they hardly come across as ancient denizens of Tarsus. They seem like a quintessential London pimp, madam, and scout. Shakespeare's Mistress Quickly from the Henry IV plays comes to mind, as does Mistress Overdone in Measure for Measure. In any case, Pander and Baud discuss their trade frankly, lamenting that venereal disease is continually damaging and diminishing their stable of prostitutes and their customers alike. Ironically, their business entails hawking and vending innocence or chastity itself, because that, and not simply sexual license, is what sells. Young virgins appeal to the clientele, of course, in part because they're unlikely to cast the user straight into the maw of syphilis or some other dread STI, but also because so many men apparently fantasize about recovering their own youth and maximum potency by deflowering a young maiden. In this regard, Bolt is quite important to Pander and Baud's success. He operates as a public relations professional, a Jacobean-style madman, after the phrase coined by Madison Avenue advertising agents to describe themselves, whose task it is to sell an image of beauty combined with flawless virtue. We can say image because, as we can see, Bolt has no intention of allowing Marina to begin her duties in the chaste condition he's talking up. After receiving his advertising instructions from Baud, he insinuates that he wants to break in Marina as the newest member of Team Prostitute, since Bolt, as he puts it, has, quote-unquote, bargained for the joint. Baud offers first use to him. Thou mayest cut a morsel off the spit. Act 4, Scene 2, lines 52 through 56, 119 and 120. Baud has her own job to do in convincing the impossibly virtuous Marina that the attractions of her new role in life merit the inconveniences. She tries to sell the young woman on an image of cosmopolitanism and sexual variety. Baud promises her, quote-unquote, you shall live in pleasure, and, quote-unquote, you shall have the difference of all complexions. Act 4, Scene 2, lines 70 and lines 73 through 74. That is, she will experience sex with men from all over the world. None of this claptrap impresses Marina, who peppers the scene with verbal indications that she is more than a match for her disreputable keepers. So Baud and company have their work cut out for them. In truth, to judge from the early part of Pander and Baud's conversation, the business has begun to lose its appeal for them, or at least it has for Pander, who worries about its disreputable standing with gods and men. Baud pitches in that she has raised 11 illegitimate children born to customers, and Pander reminds her that she has recycled them into the trade as prostitutes. This is no calling, no proper religious mystery sect, nothing hail or holy, as was sometimes held to be the case with ancient temple prostitutes. Act 4, Scene 2, line 35. It's just commerce, like almost everything else, only dirtier, and we can recognize, even if Pander, Baud, and Bolt may not, even dehumanizing. Bolt says that he has gone into the marketplace and talked up the new girl's wondrous virtues, offering potential customers an accurate sense of her appearance. Quote unquote, I have cried her almost to the number of her hairs, he tells Baud. Act 4, Scene 2, lines 86 through 87. As Shakespeare, his probable collaborator George Wilkins, and his audience must have known, it wasn't as if humane care and consideration awaited women trapped in this terrible cycle of abuse and then cast out when disease stripped them of their ability to contribute. Such a piece of slaughter the sun and moon ne'er looked upon. Cleon is beside himself over what Dionysa has done, but the two will cover it up and lie when Pericles returns for Marina. In Act 4, Scene 3, Dionysa is a bit like a lesser Lady Macbeth, goading her husband into complicity with her depraved attempt to have Marina killed. As she says to him, quote unquote, I do shame to think of what a noble strain you are, and of how coward a spirit. Act 4, Scene 3, lines 22 through 24. Just as Antiochus and his daughter's lives were shaped and cut short by a guilty secret, envious Dionysa and cowardly Cleon will have to live with the knowledge of what she has done. Cleon is what we might call an accessory after the fact in modern legal terms, but perhaps his biggest sin is how unheroic and ordinary, even petty, he seems when placed next to characters such as Pericles, Thaisa, Marina, Cerimon, and Simonides, or even the honest fishermen of Pentapolis. His horror at what his wife has done, or rather tried to do, never abates from what it was upon his first hearing. Quote unquote, O Dionysa, such a piece of slaughter the sun and moon ne'er looked upon. Act 4, Scene 3, lines 2 through 3. Nonetheless, he will help her keep it from coming to light. To sea he bears a tempest which his mortal vessel tears. Gower's dumb show shows us Pericles lamenting Marina's supposed death, and then he describes the prince as drifting aimlessly at sea, suffering inward tempests. Act 4, Scene 4 is an internally placed chorus consisting solely of John Gower's narration, and it shows Shakespeare acknowledging the need to do psychological and emotional justice to his characters. The main characters in Pericles have been described by some critics as overly universalized and insufficiently particularized. But consider a modern television series like Star Trek. So many traumatic things happen to most of the characters in the space of one or two episodes that if the tenth part of it happened to real-life individuals, they would doubtless slip into a permanent catatonic stupor. But the Interstellar show must go on, so they don't. By contrast, when Pericles thinks he's lost Marina on top of his loss of Thaisa, he goes numb. Inwardly, stress tears at him, but outwardly he appears listless, vacant. The prince, rather like King Lear at his nadir, really does slip into a profound depression bordering on catatonia. There's a great deal of psychological realism in Shakespeare. He isn't afraid to dramatize a character's emotional and spiritual breakdown. Pericles apparently becomes unreachable to everyone around him. He vows, says Gower, quote unquote, never to wash his face or cut his hairs. He puts on sackcloth, and to sea he bears a tempest which his mortal vessel tears, and yet he rides it out. Act 4, Scene 4, lines 28 through 31. I'll do anything now that is virtuous. Pander, Bolt, and Baud are losing paying customers thanks to Marina's stubborn innocence. In Act 4, Scene 5, a pair of gentlemen, now former clients of Pander and Baud, share their astonishment at the transformation wrought in them by the angelic Marina. Quote unquote, I'll do anything now that is virtuous, says one gentleman, quote unquote, but I am out of the road of rutting forever. Act 4, Scene 4, lines 8 through 9. This girl is very bad for business. She would make a Puritan of the devil. By now, Pander, Bolt, and Baud are exasperated with Maid Marina, who costs them the business of Mytilene's governor, Lysimachus, whom she converts to virtue. In Act 4, Scene 6, the three brothel keepers are at their wits' end as to how they can overcome Marina's virtue and chastity. The Baud says, quote unquote, she would make a Puritan of the devil if he should cheapen a kiss of her. Act 4, Scene 6, lines 8 through 9. By this point, that scarcely seems like an exaggeration. Things only get worse for them in this scene since Marina resists not only the brothel keepers but the governor of Mytilene, Lysimachus. Well, she does more than simply resist. She transforms them and gets them working on her side. Marina has the poise of a biblical figure such as Daniel in the lion's den, preserved from harm by his faith in God. What we are getting in the present play, then, seems like the comic version of Christian ordeal and captivity narratives. Marina easily fends off Bolt's attempt to violate her, and her magic works wonderfully on the rakish Lysimachus, who gives her plenty of gold and promises that if she hears from him again, quote unquote, it shall be for thy good. Act 4, Scene 6, line 105. At the end of the scene, Bolt himself dutifully scampers off to find Marina an honest position of just the sort she wants, one where she can make herself useful by teaching various arts. She tells him that she can, quote unquote, sing, weave, sew, and dance, among other honorable talents. Act 4, Scene 6, line 168. Thanks for listening. The date of this audio recording is Wednesday, June 11th, 2025. The foregoing material is copyright 2025 by Alfred J. Drake. For quotations, I have relied on the Norton Shakespeare 3rd edition, 4-volume, genre-based format.